the Speaker, I can tell you that both initiatives will deliver more than what that last government attempted to when, for instance, they put out a $1 billion infrastructure scheme.
Tēnā koutou, I'm Selwyn Manning and welcome to A View From Afar. And today we are joined by political scientist Paul Buchanan and we will discuss how over the last week Israel's cyber forces destroyed a reactor in Iran and Iran has threatened to retaliate. Also, around 80,000 Russian Federation troops have mobilised around the eastern Ukraine area and also Crimea, and Russian warships have taken strategic positions in the Black Sea. And United States naval hardware has also been deployed to the region. So why are regional powers now operating and openly provoking flashpoints in the Middle East and also in territories once controlled by the Soviet Union all those decades ago? To discuss this issue, let's cross to Paul and to dig into this issue. Good afternoon, Paul.
Kia ora, Selwyn. Good to see you.
Yeah, Paul, now, good to see you too. There's so much happening around the world and there's so many questions as to why. With respect to the Iran nuclear reactor having been attacked in a cyber attack by all accounts, Stuxnet comes to mind potentially too, or a new hybrid of it. And Israel, the media inside Israel, particularly the public media inside Israel, reporting that Mossad and cyber forces of Israel actually did that attack. We've seen Iran threaten to retaliate here. Also up in Russia, as we said in the intro, there's all sorts of pressure points and all sorts of troop mobilisation orders that are going on. What do you make of all of this, Paul? What's going on here?
Well, before I get into the specifics of the two issues at hand, let's address why this matters. Because if this was just quarrels between insignificant states, border disputes, and that sort of thing, we could leave it to the parties involved to sort it out one way or another. But they're not. They have very serious implications for world peace. And it's because of the following. There's an old geopolitical concept that divides the world into shatter zones and peripheral zones. And peripheral zones are those areas where great powers can compete and oftentimes enter into conflict, but none of the conflict will reach an existential level. It will not threaten the core interests of those states. And so, for example, during the Cold War, sub-Saharan Africa was considered a peripheral area. Southeast Asia was considered a peripheral area, so on and so forth. Whereas Central Europe was considered a shatter zone, and that's why NATO and the Warsaw Pact prepared all of their forces for a major confrontation in Eastern Europe. I mean, and there was tripwires and all sorts of things to prevent any miscalculation leading to war in that shatter zone. Well, those zones, the shatter zones and peripheral zones, have shifted since the end of the Cold War. And as it turns out, they've shifted south in terms of the confrontation between now Russia and the West, and they've shifted east. Now, we've talked a lot about the potential for confrontation in the South China Sea and East Asia in general. So we'll leave that aside for today. But certainly the Persian Gulf and the Black Sea, the Northern Mediterranean, Northeastern Mediterranean Basin have all become, if not de facto shatter zones, then potential shatter zones. And so we'll start with the Israel and Iran confrontation. It's clear, the Persian Gulf, the Straits of Hormuz, that whole area, Mesopotamia, is a shatter zone. No doubt about it. We have come close to a major regional war more than once in the last 20 years, but somehow it's been averted either by luck or by the adroitness of the parties involved, to include the Iraqis.
You're talking Iraq, conflict and
Iraq, Syria. I mean, you know, all of these, yeah. You know, and then Israel with various other parties. But this confrontation between Israel and Iran, first of all, is very long term. I mean, this is just the latest iteration in a tit for tat, mostly covert, irregular war between these two states. I mean, let's make no doubt about it. This is a war in the shadows. And for one thing that's resulted from it is I would reckon that along with Chinese coal miners, the most hazardous occupation in the world is Iranian nuclear scientists, because they happen to die in remarkable numbers, given how few there are in Iran.
Although this attack is slightly different, isn't it? It's very high tech, very 21st century. It's very much in that wake of the Stuxnet type of attacks that Mossad and the United States were involved in all those years ago.
So think of it as a high-low strategy. The low is the assassination of Iranian nuclear scientists. The high is increasingly sophisticated cyber attacks on Iranian nuclear facilities, all emanating from Israel, sometimes with the knowledge of the United States, but sometimes not. But there's also kinetic activities going on. For example, in this past week, an Iranian warship was damaged by a Israeli mine, a sea mine, in the Persian Gulf. So the Israelis are mining waters outside of Iran's territorial seas. Quite frankly, that is remarkable because it is an act of war. And think of other countries. Imagine if the Chinese did this off of Taiwan. I mean, you know, the confrontation is equivalent. And you can imagine the brouhaha that would arise out of the mining of waters right outside the territorial seas of another state. Well, the Israelis have been doing this. This particular attack is interesting because the Natanz reactor complex is designed for both commercial purposes, because Iran relies on nuclear energy for some of its power, which is remarkable for a petroleum-based state, but it's also its research facilities. And these research facilities have been attacked repeatedly. Remember, they were bombed, I'd say 20 years ago, if I remember correctly, again by the Israelis in a very overt raid. Then there was the Stuxnet damaging of the centrifuge. And this one, interestingly, did not damage the commercial side of the facility. It damaged the research side. So again, targeting centrifuges, so that whatever advances could be made on the nuclear side of the equation have now been delayed. The estimates are anywhere from a year or beyond. Now, the Iranians have responded by saying that not only will they retaliate against Israel one way or another, but they've now told the West, because in the middle of this, there's all the negotiations to get Iran back to the program that Trump abandoned. They're now saying that they're going to start enriching to 60% of their natural uranium capability. That's not weapons grade yet. You have to have 90% enriched uranium in order to make a bomb.
But it's on the way. It's on the way.
It's on the way. They right now are enriching at 20%. So it's a significant step. Yeah. And so the question is, why now? Why is this happening? Well, there's two sides to this, and it's part of what we call the second image issue, which is the domestic sources for foreign policy moves. On the one hand, Benjamin Netanyahu has now managed to scrape by in the fourth election in 2 years in Israel by increasingly narrow margins.
And also so, facing corruption charges back home, allegedly.
So he's going to the well yet again, the tried and true diversion of attention towards a threat, an external threat, in order to increase nationalist support for his position. And so what Netanyahu is doing is very obvious. He's also complicating the Biden administration's approach to Iran, Netanyahu doesn't want the deal with Iran. He doesn't trust Iran. He doesn't, you know, I'm assuming he's sincere. You know, they just don't trust the Iranians. So he doesn't want to see the resumption of negotiations between Iran and the so-called P5 countries, including the United States, to prosper. So he's trying to derail it and force Biden to just give up on that project. On the other hand, the Iranians are about to have an election, I believe, within 6 months. And there we have a battle between so-called reformists, who right now are in power. Many people would not believe that it's actually the moderate and more secularist types in Iran who are in power below the Grand Ayatollah, and then the Revolutionary Guard. So Netanyahu's move, because it was Netanyahu's move, may push the Iranians into a corner. Now you'd say, well, Israel doesn't want the Revolutionary Guard or their surrogates to take over in Iran, but actually perversely, they do, because that will scuttle the deal. And then Israel can confront Iran, not as equals, but as a military superior. And the Iranians know this. So there's,
okay.
There's domestic reasons for this. The trouble is, if this tit-for-tat escalates further, it's in the middle of a shatter zone.
Yeah,
and that could bring great power confrontation. Why? And I'll finish with this. On the one side, Israel will always have the United States in its corner, for better or for worse. But on the other side, Iran has both China and Russia as patrons. And I don't think that Russia and China are going to stand around and allow Iran to be attacked with impunity, even if it is by the Israelis. They can make life very complicated for the Israelis in the region, but for the United States in general. So it's the threat of escalation into something uncontrollable. And remember, Israel does have nuclear weapons. You know, the potential for something spiraling out of control is great. So one can only hope that not only do cooler heads prevail in Tel Aviv and Tehran, but that the greater powers, you know, come into play in moderating, you know, the hotheads and getting these guys to back off. They won't negotiate directly, but hopefully they will back off from the tit for tat.
Yeah. Well said. Now, remember last week we kind of talked about those various pacts, and you've alluded to it here again. You know, that's the signing of agreements between Beijing and Tehran, and also with Russia and China and Tehran. So once again, we're seeing evidence of these two type of powers, or three shaping powers here, challenging in their own way a retaliatory a maneuver with the Western nations on the other side. But let's have a look at some of what the main media around the world are doing to cover this particular issue. And here's the BBC.
Israeli public radio says the country has carried out a cyber attack on an Iranian nuclear facility. Citing unidentified intelligence sources, the report on Khan Radio said the Mossad spy agency had carried out a cyber operation at the Natanz nuclear plant, which is key to Iran's uranium enrichment program. It said this caused more extensive damage than is being reported inside Iran. The Natanz site is in central Iran, to the south of Tehran. It's the country's only uranium enrichment site, and Iran has invested money and effort in burying parts of it deep underground beneath its mountains to make it difficult to attack from the air. On Saturday, Iran announced that new advanced centrifuges to enrich uranium had just been activated there. This is in a breach of the country's undertakings under the 2015 nuclear deal, which was, you may remember, abandoned by President Trump. And just days after talks aimed at reviving the deal resumed between the new Washington administration and Tehran.
So you can see, Paul, some of those main points that the BBC was hitting on there are ones that you have spoken about only a matter of minutes ago as well. We'll just go to how Europe is actually responding to the Russian manoeuvres around Ukraine and also Crimea. Here's DW actually
German Chancellor Angela Merkel covering has this. Called on Russian President Vladimir Putin to pull back his forces from Russia's border with Ukraine. The White House says Russia now has more troops there than at any time since conflict broke out in eastern Ukraine in 2014. The buildup has fueled fears of new fighting, but Russia insists that it is the victim of Western provocations.
Russian state television offers a different way of looking at things. It reports that Ukraine and NATO pose a threat to Russia, and not the other way around. The narrative presents Ukrainian soldiers as the aggressors, and shows video footage of Moscow's response, Russian troops engaged in military exercises in Crimea. What to the West looks like saber-rattling is viewed differently by Russia. For Moscow, it's a necessary reinforcement of its defenses against the West. The majority of the Ukrainian military understand the fatal consequences of any actions that would lead to conflict. I hope they won't be provoked by politicians who in turn are being provoked by the West, especially the United States.
So, Paul, let's talk about Russia and let's talk about what is happening up there. Once again, it's a flashpoint. It's right in the heart of concerns between the NATO-aligned countries and the Russian-aligned interests. Can you break this down for us? Explain like you did with respect to the Iran and Israel issue. What is happening on the ground in Ukraine and the Eastern Corridors in Crimea, and what is causing the Russian Federation to exert its might with massive amounts of troops and also military and naval hardware in the areas which it controls?
Well, it's certainly a complicated issue. I would believe the Russians, if it weren't for the fact that they're amassing troops along the Ukrainian border, in the areas that have been annexed in the 2014-2015 fighting that occurred. If they had put troops all along the Western Front, that is, along the border of other Baltic states, and not just the Ukraine, you could make the argument that these were exercises designed to show that Russia could defend against a NATO attack. But these troops are all concentrated along the border of southeastern Ukraine, a border region that has been de facto annexed by the Russian Federation. They're in fact issuing Russian passports to all people inside of that quadrant of the Ukraine, if you will, who can claim Russian heritage. So they're basically doing a form of colonization by osmosis.
You know what comes to mind on that point, sorry Paul to interject, is what was happening in 1938, 1939 with respect to Germany under Nazi control and those areas of German culture, if you like, and the Czechoslovakia side of the Czech border. And Russia, and Germany in that instance, making a move and justifying its interests in that particular enclave on those cultural and German descendant grounds. Is this what Russia is doing here?
Yes, it's a variation of it. Let's remember that the Ukraine used to be part of the Soviet Union, and there was a lot of intermarriage between native Ukrainians and native Russians. And so eastern Ukraine, which, by the way, is a very fertile place, it's the southernmost part of the great European plain, and obviously very well suited to large-scale land warfare. A lot of those people there are Russian, white Russians, by heritage, and so their loyalties were divided, and Russia's trying to capitalize on those divided loyalties by de facto annexing the territory, and they have annexed the Crimea. Now, what I was going to say to you is that if you look at the weaponry that they're deploying, this is not defensive weaponry. They're defending, you know, offensive weaponry. So the idea that this is for defense is farcical on the face of it once you look at what the hardware
okay. can you being amassed. Can you describe that hardware to us, please?
Sure. Assault aircraft of various sorts, both fixed wing and rotary. You just saw the paratroopers coming out of Russian aircraft. You don't paratroopers are not there to defend. They're to project power deep into enemy territory. They put in a number of naval assets. And by naval assets, I mean they put a short-haul jump ship, you know, a little aircraft carrier, as well as a number of frigates, and they bolstered. What they've done is they've moved out of the Sea of Azov, which is Russian-controlled, into the Black Sea because they have 40,000 troops in Crimea. Now, that's the other part of this, is that 40,000 troops in Crimea may well be defensive if they think the Ukrainians are going to try to take back Crimea. But the Ukrainians have no wherewithal to do so, and they haven't amassed people along, you know, the Crimean-Ukraine border. And so the 40,000 troops, at least from the Ukrainian point of view, appear to be a flanking maneuver, so that you've got 40 to the south of the Ukraine in its southernmost point, and then you've got 40,000 amassed in the southeast corner, supporting the rebels, because that southeast corner of Ukraine is under rebel, pro-Russian rebel control. And so it looks like a pincer move, a squeeze move, to which the United States has responded, I won't say feebly, but we were talking last week and in the past about symbolic politics.
Yes.
And the U.S. just informed the Turks that it's sending two destroyers into the Black Sea on what they call a routine deployment. Now, two U.S.
So that's going past, for those that don't know the region, that's around the Narrows area where Istanbul is, right on that very narrow part where coming across from, you know, Mediterranean, Adriatic into the Black Sea area. So you can almost reach or throw a stone and hit those ships as they pass. Isn't that correct?
Yeah, that's so the connection between the Mediterranean and the Black Sea is the Bosphorus Straits. And Istanbul straddles the straits. The European side of Istanbul is on the north. The Asian side of Istanbul is on the south of the strait. As you just said, it's incredibly narrow. And so you got to ask permission of the Turks to go into their territorial waters. So the U.S. did, and it's headed off into what it says is a routine deployment. I believe them, because there's nothing they can do if shooting breaks out between the Ukrainians and the Russians with two destroyers. In fact, I'd get out of the way because they will be targeted if they get too close to hostilities.
Why is all this happening now? What's going on back in Moscow with Putin and his people to actually really push the envelope? Are they sensing that as Biden builds up multilateralist kind of coalitions, that the West, or the US-led West, is becoming even more stronger by the month? And is it a timeline of opportunity that they're seeking at the moment, or are there more basic pressures, or a mix of both?
Well, you know, very good point. Let's go back again to the second image. Putin is taking a page. He doesn't need to take a page, but he's taking a page out of Netanyahu's book. He's under no election pressure, but he is under pressure because some of the oligarchs who support him, who have enriched him, who have enabled him, are now having second thoughts about him being president for life. You know, one of the things about being a long-lived dictator, and you know this as well as I do, is that your feedback loops, your ability to read the terrain, starts to erode over time. What's the old adage I told you years ago? The Buchanan brothers rule that
that's right.
when the dictator starts wearing capes, he's soon to fall.
And the lapels get bigger than the caps. Yeah.
Exactly. Well, let's face it. We see a lot of photos of him running, you know, riding around bare shirted and what have you. But the issue is there are rumblings within the ranks of the Putin regime. And he also has dissenters. Like this fellow, what's his name, Navalny, who he's managed to imprison and is now in sick bay somewhere in Siberia. He's got problems at home, and he wants to use that nationalistic diversion as much as Netanyahu would like to it. Now, the question is, who are the audiences other than the domestic audiences that he's appealing to?
But Before we do, I just wanted to reinforce for the audience the realities of the nationalistic moves that Putin has been pushing inside the country. They pump out, for example, media statements, but statements that get sent right through the Russian kind of structure. And it's military nationalism of which being pushed. For example, there was only a matter of 18 months ago a thing called the trophy train that went all the way from west of Moscow all the way east across to Vladivostok. And the Russians were putting out to their people along that line, that train line, the trophy train is going to be stopping at your station on such and such a date, et cetera, et cetera. And you may think, what on earth was on the trophy train? It was all of the stuff that they were picking up from their gains as a fighting force inside Syria. It was Toyotas with aircraft carriers or other artillery guns on the back, et cetera, picking up all sorts of things like that and building up acceptance and support for its efforts over in Syria. That nationalistic military nationalism is very, very high under the Putin regime. I just wanted to add that because some people may have missed that particular type of context.
Yeah, it's a good point. Let's remember, and again, I'm not a historian of the Russian Federation or the Soviet Union, but the Russians have a very long historical sense of grievance. Grievance that other parties want to carve out territory from Mother Russia. Grievance about the very vicious wars that they did not start, but which they certainly helped to finish. And so that military history, as you say, is much stronger in Russia than many other places. And it plays very well, particularly after the fall of the Soviet Union and the decrepit state of Russia in the 1990s under Yeltsin and that sort. In fact, that's where Putin began his rise, was out of the ashes of the Yeltsin regime. So, yeah, it plays well. But let's also remember that the audience that Putin is signaling to, and again, I like the fact that we're continuing on this idea of symbolic politics, albeit indirectly and obliquely today, is that he's signaling to the Biden administration and to NATO that they better not think of messing with him, that Trump withdrew the United States from NATO in everything but name. Trump obviously has some sort of relation with the Russians. We may eventually find out what that was. Putin's basically saying to Biden, you want to really think about any moves in Europe that we may perceive as a threat, and we're just showing you how we can rapidly deploy troops along the Eastern Front.
So how does the Biden administration read that signal then, that symbolism that's coming out of the Putin camp?
Well, that's just it. The United States right now is not in a position to really assert itself strongly, because it has yet to rebuild a lot of the security coalitions that Trump damaged. And this was not helped, although I agree with the move, by the unilateral withdrawal of U.S. troops from Afghanistan. You know, Biden just announced.
Yeah.
Yeah, he just announced that they're pulling out.
So this, in a way, is a narrow window of opportunity for those regional powers to assert themselves, to get gains, if they like, before the United States actually builds up its coalition, should I say it, coalition of the willing, and presents itself as the significant power around the world once again.
That may be their ambition. What we do know is that they're trying to push the shatter zone southwards and westwards, from the Russians' perspective. They'd rather make the Ukraine and the Black Sea a no-go area for Western powers. You know, it used to be that NATO members could transit the Black Sea. Turkey is a NATO member, but Turkey is turning slowly towards the Russian gaze. And so it's pretty clear, geopolitically speaking, that the Russians want to push the idea that you do not mess with them or their allies in the Black Sea territorial limits, if you will, northern limits. And so what I think may happen is the United States will continue to push its NATO allies to provide support to the frontline states that are confronting Russia. And I should say that we're looking at, you know, the very overt military moves that the Russians are doing along southeastern Ukraine and Crimea. But there's an ongoing cyber war going on between the Russians and various Baltic states. Estonia gets targeted regularly. Slovakia gets targeted regularly for cyber assaults of one sort or another. And that's because they're pro-Western and they're democratic. You know, they reject the former Soviet influence and they've embraced the West. So they're getting hit pretty hard by cyber means. The nice thing about cyber warfare is there's no return address on that envelope. And so you can't really point the finger. And even if you know who did it, pointing the finger can entail escalation into real conflicts. So people tend to downplay that that sort of aggressive moves. These are aggressive moves. So what we see here the Russians. Go ahead.
Yeah. Before we go into what to expect next and where solutions diplomatically may take shape, let's just take a quick transition break and we'll be back in a few seconds. Yeah, so Paul, so what we're looking at is the complexities of perhaps for all sorts of a matrix of reasons we're seeing in the Middle East there is flashpoints starting to be in evidence, and we're seeing the same as you've detailed here around the Ukrainian border with Russia and also in Crimea and also around the Black Sea, some significant kind of danger points, if you like, in evidence there as well. What would you expect, looking at the timeline, looking at all these things about, you know, mission creep, et cetera, what will you expect to see in 1 month's time? And do you feel that the NATO nations have an opportunity to diplomatically cool this down?
Well, the Russians say that the exercise is going to last 2 weeks. And assuming that there's not some sort of miscalculation or, you know, mistaken attack across the line of demarcation in eastern Ukraine between rebel territory and the sovereign territory of the Ukraine, I'll believe that to be true. They'll do their two-week exercise, but it portends...
Is that all it is? Is that all it is, though, an exercise here? Or is there significant movement, isn't there?
There is. Now, the thing is, it reminds me of conversations that I've had over the years about various Latin American militaries. And of all the militaries in Latin America, the two you don't want to mess with are the Colombians, because they have fought continuously, not only with each other, but they're very ferocious in defending their borders, and the Chileans for a variety of reasons. The Ukrainians, this is where I'm going with this parallel, the Ukrainians are a battle-hard military. They have trenches layered throughout that demarcation zone on their side. It's like World War I when you go into the eastern Ukraine. They will make it extremely costly for the Russians to advance further into the Ukraine. And so what we may be seeing is posturing to set up the de facto annexation of southeastern Ukraine. If it turns out that the majority of the people living in southeastern Ukraine would prefer to be part of Russia, given that they are there and the Russian troops are there, it may be more expedient for the Ukrainian government in Kiev to allow that to happen, just like it's had to allow the Crimea annexation to happen, and live with the new redrawn borders and avoid a war. On the other hand, the Russians need to understand that if they press their case for Russification of that region down to the far reaches of the Black Sea, it's going to prove very costly for them, And it will be a test of the mettle of NATO members, because even though the Ukraine is not a NATO member, the hard fact is that the NATO members, and the United States in particular, have committed themselves to the defense of the Ukraine in the wake of the 2014-15 Russian invasion.
And I'd just add that Ukraine has reached out to the NATO nations for at least support rhetorically. So if you're looking at the efforts of Europe, we know that Angela Merkel, for example, has already spoken out to Vladimir Putin about pulling back, taking the heat out of this maneuver, cooling the situation down. Do you believe that there still exists the ability of diplomatic efforts to actually address this conflict, this potential spark point, this flashpoint, or do you feel it's treated with contempt by Vladimir Putin's people in the first instance? Diplomacy.
Well, yes to both in a strange way. Putin has utter contempt for the Europeans. He has some contempt, but for the United States, he has utter contempt for the Europeans. He doesn't care what they want, what they ask him to do. However, what he's doing is he's trying to split the NATO alliance apart over the issue of the Ukraine. And I'd say he's doing quite well, because if Merkel and others, Boris Johnson, that crowd, go to the United States and say, hey, we have to cut a deal with the Russians about Eastern Ukraine. We need to avoid a war at all costs. If he can get the European diplomats to negotiate with the United States, not with Russia, about what to do with the Ukraine, he will have accomplished his mission. So I think it's a very adroit maneuver on his part, even though it's motivated by mostly domestic considerations, because we have to think again, Selwyn. These first 6 months of the Biden administration are a window of opportunity for all power contenders to test his mettle, to test the mettle of the Biden administration. This is their moment to push, because Biden has incredible stuff on his plate. I mean, you know, domestically, yeah. Biden is up to his eyeballs in problems. And so something may have to give between foreign problems and domestic problems. You know, they may simply throw the Ukraine in the too hard basket and say, you know what, at this moment in time, we can't deal with it as peer equals with the Russians, because the Russians are on the ground there. So you know, you'll see testing going on.
Yeah, that makes sense, you know? Isn't it? You know, going back over all the decades, you always saw that there were defining moments of a new president that usually happened within the first 2 years. And we saw it with George W. Bush, of course, and that absolute tragedy in New York. We saw it with, you know, all the others that were tested in some way. We saw Kennedy being tested all of those years ago. History shows us, for example. With this whole thing, do you believe that it is folly for the United States, considering the pressures that the Biden administration has domestically and also on the trade front, do you think it is folly for it to really push the envelope too far forward right at this time? Is it better for the United States to maneuver its military hardware, for example, naval hardware around the Black Sea, perhaps in months' time? Is it, for example, just to put it into a paraphrase, is it, as Condoleezza Rice used to say, regional issues should be resolved by regional powers?
Well, I think that's going to wind up being the primary approach of the United States. I mean, let's think of it this way, just to show you how this can go serious, Lauren. Let's say that the hawks in the administration convinced the United States to do a major show of naval power in the Black Sea by trying to send a carrier group, you know, through the straits into the Black Sea. The Turks won't allow it. So then you create a confrontation with Turkey at a time when Turkey is increasingly looking towards Russia as a new security and economic partner. So that will only aggravate things rather than resolve them. The Russians will not be intimidated. And so diplomacy is the way to go, and regional diplomacy is the way to go. You know, one can never use again the phrase lead from behind, which Obama used with regards to Libya. He wanted the Europeans, who had more interest, vested interest in Libya, the Italians in particular, to lead the regime change efforts there. Of course, you saw how that wound up. The idea would be get NATO, which has its borders right on the Ukraine, to be the lead entity negotiating with the Russians and the Ukrainians towards a peaceful resolution of this dispute. The hard fact is, if we believe that possession is two-thirds of the law, then the Russians are the de facto owners of the eastern Ukraine, southeastern Ukraine. It's probably 10, 15% of Ukrainian territory has been annexed in the east, and another 10% in Crimea. It may well be that the Europeans are going to have to reconcile themselves to the fact that the Ukrainians have lost that, but in doing so, they may have gained peace. The question there is, can you trust the Russians, who, having proven successful in annexing territory from Georgia about a decade ago, you know, they took a whole portion of northeastern Georgia, and it is now de facto part of Russia. If they succeed in this move in the Ukraine, which is a much bigger, much more important state, then they can do it to pretty much anyone along their western borders, which are all very small states that used to be part of the Soviet Union and which have Russian legacy nationals in the, you know, in the population. That's the big concern, is can we trust Putin to stop at the Ukraine and to limit his ambitions there? Or is, once seeing the weakness of the West and not confronting him militarily, will he try to press in other places as well? Again, this six-month window of opportunity is the decisive moment for the Europeans to make up their minds whether to confront or conciliate.
And a test for the Biden regime, too, Biden administration as
certainly
well.
Certainly is.
Paul, thank you for your company today and also your expertise. And to those of you that are watching this live and also on demand by the podcast syndications that a view from.
Hey, and Selwyn, can I just say one thing that it just flashed in my mind, because this is some of what our utility is. In the one of the video casts that you did, the first one, the announcer said that the Iranians had abandoned the nuclear, you know, talks, that they, that's not true. The United States abandoned that deal.
Under Trump.
And so the deal is dead. And so what's going on, and she tacitly admitted it by saying that they were trying to restart or resurrect the talks. We're now back to square one with Iran. They did not abandon the deal. The United States did. And this is where these Western narratives can be very counterproductive, because the Iranians were honoring their side of the deal, and Trump decided basically to scuttle it. So, you know, we can't cast the finger of blame at the Iranians, even though we really don't like the character of their regime.
Yeah, and that explains in large part as well why the rationale that you were putting with respect to Israel, that it sees an opportunity of scuttling that deal once and for all, in acknowledging that the Biden administration actually wants those talks to take place, as do the Europeans and the NATO nations. On that point, Paul, thanks for pointing that out. And once again, to the audience that is viewing this live, and also for those of you that are listening to it or watching it on demand, we invite you to come back again. Usually we're broadcasting this time next week, which is Thursday midday in New Zealand time, or Wednesday evening, early evening, United States Eastern Standard Time. Thank you for your company. Goodbye.